The joys of the teenage years are only just beginning.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
An excellent 4 Extra debut drama coming up for you this afternoon. It's written by John Mortimer and it's set in Moscow in the 1980s. Anna Massey, Clive Merrison and Boris Izarov, better known to us as Russian tycoon Leonid from Ambridge Extra, star in Glasnost at 3 o'clock. Till then, the yet-to-be-famous John Constable continues to pursue the love of his life, Maria Bicknell. But she's the daughter of a wealthy lawyer, and there's much family disapproval on both sides. Based on the correspondence between John and Maria, this is part two of Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. The reader is Anton Lesser.
The courtship had gone well during the autumn of 1809. So, when Constable returned to London in the new year of 1810, he decided to take the next step. This was to pay a visit to Maria's family. The Bicknells lived at the very hub of London. Their home, 3 Spring Gardens Terrace, was just off Charing Cross, where, according to Dr. Johnson, the full tide of human existence could be encountered. The preoccupations of the Bicknells were, as you might expect from their address, metropolitan. Constable's visit to the Bicknells was a success, as he wrote to his mother, who was gratified by the news. By March, he had confided in her his newfound ambition, to marry Maria Bicknell. Anne Constable, alone of all the 4 parents involved, supported this match. Nonetheless, she was anxious about what she heard. Constable's mother was also his most steadfast ally in his equally bold plan to become a painter, but she was aware of, and often fretted about, his tendency to despondency, inertia, and depression. Often she urged him on to greater efforts. "Your last letter," she wrote this time, "in most parts pleased me because it was written with more energy than usual. You must exert yourself if you feel a desire to be independent." And she added a cautious qualification. "You must also be wary how you engage in uniting yourself with a housemate or any other yokes," by which she meant, of course, children. For a while, Charles Bicknell seemed positively to encourage the relationship between John Constable and his daughter. Possibly, Bicknell, a respected lawyer, experienced in human affairs of all kinds, suspected that in time it would fade away of its own accord, as so many love affairs do. He must have been well aware from the beginning of the perils of marriage on insufficient money. For John Constable did not just want to be a painter. He wanted to be a particular kind of painter, a landscape artist. And he was not merely set on being a specialist in depicting the countryside. He wanted to do so in a particular, unconventional way. Thereby, he made things even more difficult for himself than they would have been anyway. Constable did not have the emollient manner necessary for a society portraitist, comparable to that required by a society dentist or doctor. He was too private and prickly a man. Nor did he have a suitable style. Society portraiture required the sitter to appear grand or glamorous, whatever their actual appearance. Landscape was a more risky path in art. Constable was set on a variety of landscape painting that focused on the real, sometimes humble, facts of the rural scene, and this had turned out to be both difficult to do and hard to sell. Almost 8 years before his interview with Maria's parents, Constable had paid a visit to the Royal Academy exhibition in London, which always opened at the beginning of May, and he was unimpressed with what he saw. "There is little or nothing in the exhibition worth looking up to," he wrote to a friend. "The great vice of the present day is bravura, an attempt at something beyond the truth. In endeavouring to do something better than well, they do what in reality is good for nothing. Fashion always had and will have its day, but truth only will last." There were 2 sorts of artist, Constable argued. One, intent only on the study of departed excellence or what others have accomplished, becomes an imitator of their works. The other seeks perfection at its primitive source, nature. It was crucial, Constable thought, right from the beginning, to go out and sketch in the landscape itself. For a landscape painter, the equivalent of experimental data was the open-air sketch. Ever since Impressionism, this has seemed the obvious and inevitable way for an artist to paint a natural scene. Historically, however, that wasn't always the case. The great landscape painters of the 17th century, Rubens, Claude, Ruysdael, had made studies from nature, but many of their successors had not. Constable quoted with particular scorn the example of the French painter François Boucher, who was famous for saying, "He never painted from the life, for nature put him out." Boucher's landscapes, charming to lovers of Rococo, reduced Constable's mind to a state of bewilderment from which laughter alone can relieve it. Boucher's countryside, Constable objected, was inhabited by opera dancers with mops, brooms, milk pails and guitars, and his scenery diversified with winding streams, broken bridges and water wheels. Hedge stakes danced minuets, while groves of trees bowed and curtsied to each other. Constable, by contrast, would find his subject in the countryside, then sit down, resting a sketching box on his knees, and work on a surface, paper, canvas or board, pinned to the lid. Thus equipped, he was ready to apply himself to studying the primitive source, nature itself. He was very methodical in his practice, painting one view only for a certain time each day. When the shadows from objects changed, his sketching was postponed until the same hour the following day. It was Constable's fundamental insight that in painting landscape, one is not depicting a given number of three-dimensional items, hills, trees, cows, but instead an immensely complex natural system at a specific moment. To the end of his life, he remembered a lesson he received from Benjamin West, the kindly American president of the Royal Academy. A picture of his had been rejected for exhibition in the Royal Academy, and dejected, he showed it to West, who said, "Don't be disheartened, young man. We shall hear of you again. You must have loved nature very much before you could have painted this." Then West took a piece of chalk and added touches of light between the stems and branches of the trees. "Always remember, sir," West said as he did so, "that light and shadow never stand still." Constable liked to say that this was the best lesson on the drama of light and shade that he ever had. Like all of us, Constable remembered the advice that chimed with what deep down he wanted and needed to hear. One of his basic feelings about landscape painting was that it was the record not only of a place, but also of a time and a mood. Some years previously, Constable's wealthy uncle, David Pike Watts, had funded a journey to the Lake District. This had produced a large number of pictures, and most of his exhibited landscapes in the following few years. But it was not, as he later came to realize, a place that meant enough to him. Constable believed landscape painting ought to be not only true to the visible facts, but also flooded with feeling. His own heart was most moved by the sight of his native landscape, to which he had just begun to return. He renewed his outdoor sketching around East Bergholt more and more intensively when he declared his love for Maria. In fact, his love for her, his feelings for the place, and his art seemed connected in a deep and complicated fashion. Constable's determination to marry Maria coincided with a renewed focusing and intensification of his work. The years that followed were the ones in which he began to reach maturity as a painter, and first depicted many of the subjects that eventually brought him fame, almost all of which were around East Bergholt. When Constable presented himself at Maria's parents' house early in 1810, however, almost all the achievements for which he eventually became world famous lay in the future. If he had died of the chest infection he caught that spring, his name would barely be remembered. Charles Bicknell saw before him a man approaching middle age, who had, as yet, one little professional reputation, and that in a walk of life which was a dubious proposition at best. In worldly terms, Constable seemed a failure. Charles Bicknell had little understanding of his prospective son-in-law's art. Speaking to a lawyer about pictures, Constable concluded, perhaps with his experience of Charles Bicknell in mind, is something like talking to a butcher about humanity. Charles Bicknell didn't feel able, or didn't want, to make over a large sum to Maria. That made the will of her grandfather, the Reverend Dr. Durand Rudd, crucial to her future. Dr. Rudd, unlike Charles Bicknell, thought of himself as a wealthy man. As well as having three parishes in Suffolk, he was a chaplain in ordinary to the King and served at the Chapel Royal St. James's Palace each spring. He lived ostentatiously, with a London house at Stratton Street, a smart address off Piccadilly, conveniently close to St. James's. Dr. Rudd had risen in the world and was naturally unwilling to see his descendants decline in class and wealth. Maria was a favourite with him, and it was vital to her prospects that he should approve her choice of husband. Unfortunately for her and John Constable, his opinion on the subject of marrying a husband without funds was clear. In short, Dr. Rudd had the same opinion as Jane Austen's Mary Crawford. A large income is the best recipe for happiness I ever heard of. In the late summer of 1810, Constable returned, as he had the year before, to East Bergholt and spent the harvest season and autumn studying the countryside. On the 27th of September, he painted and dated a study of the River Stour at sunset, the sky orange, pink and grey, the colours reflected in the waters, the willows dark against the fading light. From an upper window of the Constable house, he looked across the fields where he and Maria had walked a year before. Dawn was breaking above the rectory where she had stayed. The grey clouds above Dr. Rudd's residence were blushing deep salmon shades. A few ducks flapped across the landscape. Maria was not in East Bergholt that year. But it is hard to believe that as he painted this little picture, he was not thinking of her. At first, Constable's courtship had gone well. The Bicknells were friendly. Maria herself obviously had strong feelings for him. But at some point that summer, it had begun to go wrong. The surviving sources do not allow us to pinpoint the moment when the Bicknell family's attitude changed. But change it did. And when it did, Constable slipped into a depression that badly worried his relations and friends. While Constable was sinking deeper and deeper into despair, Maria was staying at her parents' insistence at Spring Grove with her sister-in-law Sarah Ski, safely out of Constable's way. In September, Mrs. Bicknell also came to stay. The following 6 weeks, spent in the company of her invalid mother, had worn down Maria's emotional resistance. She was now firmly, if sadly, convinced that there was no further point in clinging to her hopeless attachment to John Constable. It was bad for her, bad for him, and caused needless anxiety to her poor, suffering mother and kindly father. It would have to stop.
But I have a suspicion it won't. We'll find out in part three tomorrow. Anton Lesser was reading part two of Constable in Love by Martin Gayford. It was abridged by Lou Kemp and produced by Jill Waters.
This weekend, BBC Radio 4 Extra is listening to Les.
And I just remember laughing my head off going, that's brilliant, that.
He had a terrific sense of the joy of comedy.
A whole fresh, vibrant vocabulary, describing someone with a face like a bag of chisels.
He could make a walk down the street into an odyssey.
This is like the whole history of music hall and variety entertainment rolled into one human being.
A good comedian gets applause. A great comedian like Les Dawson is loved.
Join Ray Peacock and a host of special guests as we celebrate the wonderful work of Les Dawson. Listening to Les, Saturday morning at 9 and again in the evening at 7 on BBC Radio 4 Extra.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Plenty of classic comedy to come this evening on 4 Extra. Tonight from 7, it's The Goons and The Likely Lads. But now at 3, a tale of passion in 1980s Russia in our 4 Extra debut drama. And to follow, roll up to see The Headless Lady and discover the fate of thousands of rubber bath toys that went missing in the Pacific Ocean. All that and giant hailstones too in today's 4 o'clock show coming up in an hour. Now, if you've been following Ambridge Extra, there's a voice you'll definitely recognise in today's drama. It's that of actor Boris Izharov, better known to us as Russian tycoon Leonid, who now takes on a different role, starring alongside Anna Massey and Clive Merrison in John Mortimer's wry take on the spirit of openness that overtook the Soviet Union in the 1980s. A novelist on an official visit to Moscow gets besotted with her young Russian guide, and who can blame her? But what's the real motive behind all the attention and the flattery?
Glasnost, a play for radio by John Mortimer. With Anna Massey, Boris Izharov, Clive Merrison, and Philip Voss. Glasnost.
Roast pork and roast potatoes? Oh, who ever heard of roast pork and potatoes?
I thought you'd like that, Brian. Cut off the joint and veg?
Of course I do. Of course I do. But not for breakfast, comrade. Definitely not for breakfast. I'm not eating with cold, soft, boiled eggs. Care for a cold, soft, boiled egg, Miss Denham?
I rarely eat breakfast.
Really, eh? Oh, what does that mean? Only on the third Sunday in Lent? Huh? Just to be a devil, then, do you?
When I came down this morning, I must say the breakfast came as something of a shock.
I bet it did. Think of all those vegan Trotskyites living in Hampstead.
But when in Moscow, I said to myself, do as the Muscovites do. So I took the meat.
All those poor bloody trots keeping half alive on muesli and herb tea, and they come here on some sort of pinko pilgrimage and have to start the day with bloody great slices of pork. My God, comrade, what's that muck you're drinking?
Buttermilk.
Oh, squeezing the tits of some yak in Outer Mongolia.
You should try the grape juice.
What was that? Miss Anthea Denham?
Grape juice. You should try it. It's really quite refreshing. I'll ask the waiter. Oh, waiter?
Comrade waiter.
Lady?
Oh, yes. Well, vinogradny sok, пожалуйста.
You wanted something, lady.
Grape juice. Sok. For Mr. Worsfold.
Sock it to us, comrade, for we are honoured writers. And Glitsky.
Okay, lady and gents.
Sok. That means juice in Russian. Oh, is that the time? I must go and get ready. Enjoy your sock.
You remember what Lady Macbeth said, Charles? Huh? Mm. I have given sock and know how tender it is to love the babe that milks me.
See you in the lobby.
Our sensitive lady novelist, Miss Anthea Denham. You think she's ever given sock? Charles, you honestly think so?
Grape juice, gentlemen.
Oh, yes. Thank you, comrade.
That's one of the things I don't understand about Russia.
Tell me one of the things you do understand.
I don't understand why they all speak English with American accents.
Do they? Oh, I didn't notice. Oh, my God, that's disgusting. Ooh, ugh, strong taste, a warm, watery cough mixture. I'll tell you one thing about Russia, Charlie, my old comrade. I'm never going to let them sock it to me again.
Strange sort of hotel, this. Seems to be decorated in the Chinese manner.
Yeah.
Is there a plug in your basin?
Don't be silly. There are plugs in Russia. No, plug's a sign of Western decadence. That'd be as bad as kippers for breakfast. Oh, my God, I didn't tell you, Charlie. Did I forget to tell you?
This sock's not so disgusting. if you drink it quickly.
They showed me up to my room. You know how late it was by the time we got you from the airport. My key lady flung open the door proudly. Well, it was like a haunted ballroom. Chandeliers and a painted ceiling and a bloody great oil painting of wolves in the snow.
And no plug in the basin.
Well, exactly. And you know what was on my bed?
Yeah, I'm afraid it may have been something of the cockroach variety.
Only a huge man in a blue suit and brown shoes watching television and eating pickled cucumbers out of a plastic bag. Ah. Do you know what I put it down to?
What?
Communism.
I'm sure we're going to find it extremely interesting here.
It used to smell like this in the old Station Hotel Stockport.
And I must be getting ready. We are meeting our guide in the lobby at 5:30.
Guys? Is that what you call him? I reckon he's the man from the Kellogg's Golly Berry Breakfast.
The man from the what?
K-G-B.
My name is Vladimir. I'm your guide, and I hope I will also become your friend and...